One obvious question is why should one be interested in the quantum Baker's map? And I've got a few, well, personal answers to this question. One is, after yesterday's talk, it's pretty clear that there are many questions in quantum chaos that are very difficult to answer. You need very big computers to answer them. And the reason one uses these big computers is that finding real answers, or let's say, non-numerical answers, is even more difficult, maybe even impossible. So if one doesn't have access to Los Alamos supercomputers, one should maybe try to look at the simplest possible quantum map, simplest possible chaotic quantum map, and see whether one can learn, well, some things there. So this is one reason to look at the quantum Baker's map. Another one is in the context where if you look at the title of this conference, it's called Quantum Chaos and Quantum Information in the title, and it's not just an amalgamation of two different subjects. I believe that that one can learn important things about quantum chaos by using methods from quantum computation and quantum information theory. And even vice versa, one can learn something about quantum computation by studying quantum chaos in the context of quantum computation. So it just gives some ideas about this, what one can learn in these two contexts. So one is learning about quantum chaos from quantum computation. One obvious thing is one might be able to use quantum computers once one has got them to study quantum chaos. So to find answers that even Los Alamos quantum computers couldn't find. The second answer is, and this is what I'm going to focus on most in this talk, that by looking at quantum maps as represented on qubits, one might be able to develop methods similar to classical symbolic dynamics. So find analytical, rigorous results for quantum chaos problems that are elusive by other methods. Then what can one learn about what benefits are there for quantum computation? One is that quantum chaos simulations provide applications for quantum computers that may give you results even, say, with 50 qubits or 100 qubit quantum computers. 50 qubits are completely useless if you are after number theory results. But for simulating chaotic systems, that may be useful. Also, another idea is one can find demonstration experiments for 3, 4, 5, 10 qubits that might be feasible very soon. In the quantum chaos context. Well, and last but not least, one might get some insight about quantum mechanics, the structure of Hilbert space, quantum information, by studying quantum chaos in a way that is really my original motivation for looking at the quantum Baker's map. The original motivation was I have a very old conjecture, about 10 years old, with Carlton Caves, that quantum systems can display something we call exponential hypersensitivity to perturbation. And we have been unable to show this in any serious sense. And so, as I said before, looking at the quantum Baker's map as the simplest possible map seemed like a good idea. And let me just say very briefly one of the possible insights from the study could consist in. It's related to the size of Hilbert space. Look at a 300 qubit quantum computer. It's got about 10 to the 100 dimensional Hilbert space. That's big. That's Google dimensions of Hilbert space. I'm talking about Google all the time right now because my 7-year-old son is fascinated with big numbers, and when he has these fantasies of, say, being the fastest runner in the whole universe, and when he wants to quantify this, he says, "I can go Googleplex miles per hour." So I'll try to tell him that there's nothing you could really Googleplex could mean, because it's just far too big, 10 to the Google. What could this be? Well, there's something that could be. In a 300 qubit Hilbert space, there are Googleplex distinguishable quantum states. What distinguishable means, anything you like. Let's say the overlap is the mod of the inner product is less than 1/2. So, and that's just 300 qubits. So Hilbert space is big. The Hilbert plex is a number that quantifies this in a very meaningful sense. And our conjecture was that chaotic quantum systems, chaotic quantum dynamics, together with random stochastic perturbations, explores all these possibilities in some sense. So it explores a sizable fraction of these Googleplex states in some sense. So if that turned out to be true, or not to be true, one would have learned something about quantum mechanics from the study of quantum chaos. So enough. My collaborators on this, just mentioned them. Andrei Sokolkov used to be my student, and he has done a lot of the hard work here. With Todd Brown, I've done, well, Todd and Carl are here in the audience, I don't have to know much about them. And here's my outline. So I'm going to tell you something about the classical Baker's map first and symbolic dynamics. Move on to the quantized unit square. Then I say some words about the quantum Fourier transform and the quantum Baker's map, because quantum Fourier transform is really the context in which to understand the quantum Baker's map. Then I tell you about three ways to understand the quantum Baker's map as a shift on qubits, which provides the link to classical symbolic dynamics, where you look at the map as a shift on strings, binary strings. I talk briefly about problems with efficient simulation of quantum maps and quantum computers, about an experimental realization, about entropy increase, this famous measure of or signature of chaos, linear increase of entropy, some results where this is approached via a coarse graining approach, simple results where this is approached via an environment approach, and simple result about diverging states. I'll tell you about what that means later. So, classical Baker's map first. Here's a photocopy from a famous book, Arnold and Aves, on chaos, classical chaos. And this is the Baker's map. So this is Arnold's illustration. You take the unit square, you just stretch it like this, so this is the stretched unit square, and then you take this piece and move it up there. Well, people who actually bake tell me that this is not what a baker does, because a baker would actually fold it back like this, but...
It's a big croissant, you might.
That's the map. So if you iterate that map, a cat or whatever you place in that square suddenly becomes, well, very, very, well, it's like a millefeuille or something like this. Lots of things, and you can't really recognize anything of the original structure in there. So, the classical Baker's map is neat because it's got a trivial or very, very easy to grasp symbolic dynamics. This is unit square, so take the numbers Q and P and write them as binary fractions. So Q's and P's, they're all 0, 1, so they're binary expansions. And now you can represent this point here, QP, in the following way as a single bi-infinite string. The Q's run to the right and the P's run to the left from the dot. Okay. So this corresponds essentially one-to-one to them, not quite one-to-one, but essentially one-to-one to the points in the phase space here. And it's very easy to see that the action of the map can just consist in shifting the dot one position to the right. That's easy to see because what do? You stretch the Q direction, which means multiplying Q by 2. That means, of course, that the dot should be here. You divide, you flatten the P direction, so you divide by 2, so the dot should move to the right, and then you just need to see what happens to the carry bit, and that just takes care of things just in the right way. So this is how it works. And with this representation, you can see all kinds of things almost immediately. The Kolmogorov-Schumer entropy, for instance, 1 bit per step, that's the information you need to provide per step asymptotically in order to keep your ability to predict the trajectory to a certain accuracy. Well, that's just 1 bit per step, as you can see immediately here. You also can talk about diverging trajectories. You can see very easily what all the Now, periodic orbits are how they approach, how things diverge from them. You can study almost everything very easily in this representation. It looks very special, of course. And now here, this is to, I don't know, this is here. You can interpret these numbers in the following way quite nicely. Q1 tells you whether you're in the left or the right half of the square. So what does Q2 tell you? Well, Q2 tells you whether the first iterate of the map is left or right. Q3, whether the second iterate is left or right. P1, whether the first backward iterate is left or right, etc. So this idea can be generalized to show that this kind of symbolic dynamics is very, very general. Let's look at a...
why is it one bit and not two bits? Don't you need a bit from both, intuitively?
Well, it's sufficient to have... it's sufficient to just like this. You could also do it with 4 and have 4 numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3. But then you would find that not all sequences actually represent states. You could easily do it. But you would then find that there's a grammar which forbids certain sequences from ever occurring. So this is more... okay, so here's how we do it in general. Let's just take T, the map from the set gamma to the same set gamma, and just partition it for the moment in an arbitrary way in 4 sets A1, A2, A3, A4. Then any point here defines in the way I just described a string, where the omegas are from the alphabet 0, or here is 1 to 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, right? And omega n tells you in which of these sets the nth iterate of the point x falls, that's all. So for example, if this is the string, then the first backward iterate is in A1, the point itself is in A4, the first iterate is in A2, the third iterate is in A3, now also in A2, etc. So this is how, for any map, I mean, of course, any point defines a string like that. Well, the great thing about chaotic maps, or a large class of chaotic maps, is that they exist so-called generating partitions for which the string, any such string, obeying from a certain class of strings, from the set of all allowed strings, essentially uniquely determines the point in phase space. So you have a one-to-one correspondence, apart from some trivial set of strings, a one-to-one correspondence between these strings and these points. So this is only true for chaotic maps, and it's only true if your partition is well chosen, but there are methods for that. And so in this way, in principle, essentially any chaotic map can be represented by such a symbolic dynamics. So studying the quantum Baker's map, the classical Baker's map is really studying a very, very generic problem.
Excuse me. Does there exist such a partition for any completely chaotic map? Or do there exist chaotic maps for which this cannot be done?
I believe there exist maps for which it cannot be done.
But they are pathological?
They are pathological. So, I mean, my understanding was that as a physicist you need not be interested in these maps.
Well, for instance, you could have a map that has two fixed points in the same region. Right? That would break it immediately. Because if you have a fixed point, if you have two fixed points in region A2, then they will both be defined.
The point is you have to choose your partitions.
Yeah.
Cleverly, right. So, avoid
and you can live with trivial, very small ambiguities. So. Okay, now let's move to this. So this is just to claim that the quantum Baker's map is, well, not completely generic, but is typical for a very, very large class of problems. So here's, now we want to quantize it, so we want to quantize the unit square. So this is how you do it in a traditional way due to, well, Weyl, it's in this 1950 Dover book on quantum theory and group theory, quantum mechanics and group theory. So you have two unitary operators, U and V, that's what we start from, and you make these requirements here. You require that they commute in this way, so if you flip them over, you just acquire a phase, and the phase is e to the 2 pi I over d, where d is the dimension of Hilbert space you want to get in the end. And you say that u to the d and v to the d are both equal to plus 1, or alternatively both equal to minus 1. It's going to correspond to different kind of boundary conditions, so I'm not going to dwell on here. From these conditions, you can show that u and v can be written in this form, e to the 2 pi I q and e to the minus 2 pi I p. So if you interpret q and p as position and momentum, then u and v are just displacements in p and q directions. You also can show that q and p have eigenvalues. They're just equally spaced along the unit interval. So q has eigenvalues. Well, the plus 1/2 applies in the minus 1 case here. So the plus 1/2 goes away if you have a plus here, and it is there if you have a minus sign. So it's just a different kind of boundary conditions leading to different way these points are mapped. So. Now the quantum Baker's map is now a map on the quantized unit square. And here is my quantized unit square. So I have in 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space, so d is 2 to the n. Here are my positions, here are my momenta, just spaced with a distance of 1 over 2 to the n. And here's a reminder, the qj are position eigenstates with eigenvalue qj. I know this is what you cannot define, of course, or write down a Fourier transform. It takes the state qj to a Fourier transform state like this, so just a standard Fourier transform where you sum over all k from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1, and basically divided by 2 to the n is absorbed in the qj, and you find that this is just the state pj, which is the momentum eigenstate, which is written down here. So the quantum Fourier transform goes from the position basis to the momentum basis in this way. And, the next step is, if you want to represent the Baker's map on qubits, next step is to write qj as a state on n qubits. So then it actually becomes much closer to the quantum Fourier transform, because it's a transformation of n qubits. So what do we do? So we just write the number qj here, which is between 0 and 2 to the and 1. Essentially, we write it as a binary fraction with n bits. And instead of summing over k, we sum over log over n binary variables here. Well, what we get that way is written up here. So as such an example for n equal to 3, I write qj, the position eigenstate, as a binary expansion. I put a dot here. This is going to lead to something like the Baker's shift map thing. This state is the same as a computational eigenstate, computational basis state of a quantum register. And then the quantum Fourier transform applied on this computational basis state looks like this. It's the sum of these four binary variables here. So what the sum over k becomes a 4 over the sum over those, and this is k, of course, and here it's expanded. And here I have my binary 0. Xi1, Xi2, Xi3, which is qj. So this is the standard expression for the quantum Fourier transform. This was for a different audience. I think probably here most people know that this state is not entangled, but it certainly, when you see it for the first time, is a big surprise. So the very nice way to write this state, the Fourier transform state, is like this. It's a product state, and all the terms are equal superpositions of 0 and 1 with different phases. The phases are determined by the original bits here. So since this is going to be useful, I think I'm going to show you how to do this using a quantum computer, quantum gates. So start a little bit here. So let's start with 3 qubits, so long as I took set 3 like this, and do a Hadamard transform here. Hadamard transform is going to transform it to 0 plus 1 if this is 0, into 0 minus 1 if this is 1. So this is just this, well, elaborate way of writing the same thing. Depending on psi 1, you get a phase factor of e to the 0, e to the pi, e to the I pi here. So next, what we want is to achieve, well, this is going to be this qubit here. So we want to have this psi 2, and it's very easy to do. All you do is you have a controlled pi over 2 rotation here. Now, depending on the value of psi 2, you either pick up this phase pi over 2, or you don't. And this is just written in a brief way like this. And of course, you can do the same thing to pick up the third term. You have a pi over 4 rotation control on this qubit, and you pick up the phase or you don't, depending on the value of psi 3. And then you do the same thing for psi 2 and psi 3, doing this and this, and you find just the three terms you want, but in the wrong order. So in order to actually achieve a quantum Fourier transform, you have to permute, just flip the order of the three qubits, when you're done. So, here we are. This is a quantum Fourier transform. You change the order and you do these gates. And what I've done here in addition is write down a phase space representation of these states. So this is a position eigenstate. I'm writing down, let's say, a Hussemi distribution, a Q function for the state. So the Q function of a position eigenstate is localized at this point, of course. It's completely delocalized in the P direction, and its width is about 2 to the minus n, roughly. It falls off. Actually, it's pretty well localized, in some sense, perfectly localized. After I get the Fourier transform, what I get is a P eigenstate with the same eigenvalue. So that's a state with a Q function that looks like this. And I invent a new notation for that. This is the state that's localized at open psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, same place as this, but just according to my symbolic dynamics, for the basis of symbolic dynamics, I just invent this notation for this kind of state. I put a dot at the right, to the right, and write them in the wrong order, so it looks like the classical symbolic dynamics. Next thing I need is a partial Fourier transform. Because I can perform a Fourier transform on just a subset of the qubits. Here's an example. This is the position eigenstate, but I choose to Fourier transform only these two qubits here. What I get is a state which I choose to denote like this. So psi 3 and psi 4 are untouched. So these two. So one and psi 2 are Fourier transformed. So this is, if I write down the Hussemi function or the Q function for this state, this will be localized roughly at opening psi 3, psi 4, location unchanged. Momentum, opening psi 2, psi 1, different order here. And it's got a width of, in this case, well, just 1/4 in each direction. So in this way you can get phase space blobs like this, localized at any of these lattice points with arbitrary width. And the total area, of course, is always essentially H for these things. So now I do this again. I'm being, approaching the Baker's map at enormous speed. So almost there. So now I do the same thing. Well, it looks quite arbitrary at the moment. It's another example. Now I do the same thing with one more qubit transformed, Fourier transformed. So obviously I will get something that is barely localized in position. It's just determined by one position bit, but it's better localized in momentum now, like that. See, I mentioned here that the order here is takes into account that it just didn't do the flip here, but this is technicality of pollution. So this is another of these partially fully transformed states. And now, let's see, if you look at this and this here, this looks like like an application of the Baker's map. I mean, if you take this pattern and this pattern, this is exactly the classical Baker's where it goes from here to here. And if you look at this representation, it's a dot that shifts by one position. So it looks very Baker's mappy. And you can just put these two together now, these two things. So if you're going to go from here to here, you just take this circuit. You go this way here. Then you permute these labels, so you get those labels. And then you go this way here. And you have your circuit for your quantum Baker's map. Well, that's exactly what we do. So, yeah. So notice this is a classical Baker's map here. This is how we define the quantum Baker's map. And this is how the circuit goes. So I start here. This is this state. I do this backwards. Then I permute them, and you see it's just a shift of the bits. Cyclic shift of the qubits. And then you do this stuff here, and you end up there. And so we have to find one quantum Baker's map.
So what happens when a decimal point gets to the end of the state? That certainly seems to be an important question here. Does it cycle back around? I mean, you're shifting the decimal point. You have a finite number of digits, unlike classical.
Ah, yeah, okay. This is an important question. I mean, this defines the map. So this is one basis here. All the strings with the dot in this position is a basis. Right? These, I mean, you're just assuming that next step you apply the same map, the dot shifts one position further, and it doesn't. Because the map is a unitary map, so you have a basis here, and you have the, for each basis you have an image here, and this is another basis. So if you want to apply the Baker's map to this state, you have to re-express it in this basis. So it's not a trivial map. Otherwise, you would have just a permutation of the labels. So you get one Baker's map for each position of the dot here, and there are different quantizations of the classical Baker's map. So it's an excellent question because it also puts the finger on something that one shouldn't really forget here. In a sense, all this isn't convincing at all. You could punch big holes in it, because you could say, well, look, any unitary can be written this way. You just choose to write your given basis in this form here, then you write a new notation for the image basis in this way, and you have a shift map. So there's nothing here. Similar to this, you have a shift of these qubits here. But, not quite in this case here, but let's look at the extreme here. Here's a hierarchy of Baker's, and we have a whole hierarchy of quantum Baker's maps now here. They are all those things. So this is the one extreme where my dot ends up in the extreme position, and this is the other extreme where my dot starts at this extreme position. Right. And there's everything else in between. Now this is the original map defined by Balazs and Saraceno about 10 years ago. So this is the original quantization here. This is a trivial map. You just cycle the qubits. It's this is essentially just a permutation of your
set. Yeah. And you say that to move the dot from place I to place I plus 1, mm-hmm. the shift is different than to move it from I plus 1 to I plus 2.
Yes, and you can see this very, very strongly here, right?
So if you apply it on a superposition, mm-hmm. if you want to apply the math on a superposition, you don't get
to
apply the Baker's map on all
the
states, right?
I quite understand.
So if you start with a superposition of different states with the dots in different places.
Oh no, but then we can do that. But then you have to re-express all your states in the one basis. You have to define four, and then you only apply it. So these are all different Baker's maps.
Yeah.
And you always have to express, if you want to apply this rule, you have to express your original state, whatever your position is, it may be, in this basis. So there's no direct way of taking a state with a dot in the wrong position and apply the map to it.
But is there one map that applies to all states? I mean,
all of the maps apply to all states. But they're different forms.
All the states of this form, this is this form from a basis, complete basis.
Yeah.
So the map is defined by its action on all these states. That's it.
I mean, the map is a basis independent operator, right?
That is also true, yes.
And so, and it's just that if you wanted to look at its representation, it has, as a trivial thing of moving a dot, it only applies in one basis set. If you bring a dot in a different way, then it would be a different unitary operator.
Yeah.
So what does this map do to a state where the dot is one step before?
Well, I think I'll give you an answer to that just in a second, next transparency, okay? There's just another way of saying that, in this case at least, all the shift character could be completely bogus. I mean, it's just a complicated set of gates here. Right? You could easily imagine to have a set of gates that just undoes exactly everything that has happened here, and so you can write anything as a shift like this with a lot of stuff going on over here, right? So, I mean, I believe that these representations tell you a lot about the quantum Baker's map, but you have to understand that you could cheat very easily here.
Question.
So, yeah.
In the limit where the number of qubits gets very, very big, so let n go to infinity, mm-hmm. then do the maps for the decimal place being in adjacent locations approach each other? In other words, because classically that's what you would expect, but it doesn't matter where you put the decimal place. Does that?
No, they don't. Here's a simple question. This map doesn't entangle at all. This entangles a lot. That applies for as many qubits as you want. Sorry?
The decimal places, I mean, if there were 1,000 qubits there, uh-huh. you would expect you couldn't compare the decimal place being here,
okay,
here
I see.
But just adjacent points.
That's an interesting question.
Maybe it's not
a question. No, I don't know. I don't know the answer, but it sounds interesting. That's something I could look at. So here's, okay. So in order to really establish that Baker's map is a shift map, what you need to know is, you need to do is look at it in a single basis. So let's just look at the Baker's map in this basis here. Actually, I can't tell you now which one it is, whether it's the one that moves this dot to the right or this dot to the right. So we can look it up, but it's one of the two. It's not an arbitrary one that goes somewhere. So what I want to do is I want to express it in a single basis and discover that it has a shift character, a shift map character, because otherwise, I mean, I have shown you that my first two ways of writing as a shift map don't tell you anything. So here's the answer, which actually was surprisingly hard to find, which could be regarded as the first benefit of really looking at the map in the qubit representation, because this explicit representation of the matrix elements of the map was not published before, so apparently was not known. So this is an explicit representation of the matrix elements of the quantum Baker's map in a particular basis. It is a useful basis to look at, and you can see that this delta function here, so you have on the left you have the xi's, on the right you have the phi's, and the delta function just, it tells you that you have to shift the xi's onto the phi's, where this n plus 1 and this n 1 here are irrelevant. So the major element actually, you see it's a perfect shift of the position qubits, of the position bits. You see also in what sense it is a shift of the momentum bits, because the momentum bits of the phi's from 1 to n and phi's from 1 to n here, they appear down here. They just appear in the argument of a sign, in inverse sign. So this is a approximation of a delta function. Well, it's got long tails. So the localization in p direction, or the shift character in p direction, is just not as good. And this phi here is just a trivial phase factor in front. So it's actually a very simple expression for these matrix elements. And it establishes that the map is a shift map in a precise and actually unambiguous sense. So, now I come to, this is the first result. Here's another result, which is of course an obvious one if you look at the gate sequence. You can do an efficient simulation of the quantum Baker's map in a 2 trillion dimensional Hilbert space with an n-qubit quantum computer. If you want to do a classical simulation of the same thing using fast Fourier transforms, you need a memory of 2 to the n bits, and the time goes like n 2 to the n. On a quantum simulation, your memory is just n qubits, and the time goes like n squared. So this is the same improvement as for the quantum Fourier transform, obviously, because just two quantum Fourier transforms. Now, I put this question here, an open problem, how to extract useful information from the quantum simulation. I mean, you run the simulation, you get a state in the end, but what do you do with it? If you measure it, you get a random string of n bits. That's not very interesting. So the question is how to extract useful information from the quantum simulation without running it an exponential number of times. I said it was an open problem, then I crossed this out again because Dima Shepelyansky and Bertrand Georgeot sort of convinced me that I solved the problem. But I think it's still a semi-open problem. Because they haven't quite convinced anybody. It is possible that, for instance, the statement there are stated. You could compute the localization length, for instance, in certain problems. They state this. It could be true that this is actually correct, and then this problem would be solved in certain cases.
So what's the solution?
I want to see the. Sorry.
So what's the solution to the problem?
Well, I don't know, but they claim that you could actually find the localization length. For not the Baker's map, but a more interesting map with a mixed space, with a mixed space.
Well, I think it's just that if your final state is localized somewhere, you just measure a few times until you find where you're at. Yes. Zero.
Okay.
As far as I understood, they apply for Fourier transform on the final state, and then they find moments.
Well, even then, you must make assumptions about the moments. Right?
I don't know what assumptions are. I thought this is what you do.
This is another thing, yeah. It's independent of the localization, I think. Okay, if it's localized momentum, then.
But you mean clearly, localization is a very special problem. So that's not a solution, but this seems to be a much more interesting question in this particular
case. Yeah, it's certainly a wider question. Other things? Quantum Baker's not experimental 3-qubit NMR quantum computer. It's something that Todd and I proposed 2 or 3 years ago. And ever since then, MIT people have told us that they actually did the experiment. But they've never seen anything of this. So, Settler told me that he did the experiment.
98.
No, but 4 or 5 months ago. He said, definitely, we've done it. And so, but I still haven't seen it.
And you said he told you at QCM in 98?
He also did telling me that. Well, he then told me that they were about to do it. They had done the Fourier transform and would do this thing next.
They either have done or
anyway. but I think it was an interesting experiment, and here's just a very brief outline of it, how you could do that. This is actually not the molecule they would use, it's the molecule that your colleagues and Los Alamos used a lot, and of course left behind a long time ago. So this one would be that one of the 3 qubits here. They sit on the hydrogen and the 2 carbons here. Essentially, there's coupling only between these two. You can neglect the rest. And this is the simplest Hamiltonian you can write down without making a terrible mistake. So this is a huge simplification of Hamiltonian, but it's a justified simplification. You couldn't drop any other terms without it being criminal. And then the Baker's map corresponds to a pulse sequence. This looks somehow like this. This is a special case. But so each of these pulses, this is a pulse that rotates the spin of the H molecule by an angle of minus 3 pi over 2, or maybe half of it. Can't quite remember these things. And this is what on the x-axis. This is the y rotation of the H molecule by this angle, etc. And these pulses are assumed to be very, very fast, instantaneous essentially, and then you let evolve the thing under its own, under this Hamiltonian here. So this is what these arrows mean here. This is you let this thing evolve for a time of pi over j1. So the total time this takes is actually obtained by just adding these numbers here. And this is a problem with such a simulation, because it's relatively long. It runs for a long time. And the decoherence time is about a factor of 100 slower than this time 1 over J1 here. So you actually get a lot of decoherence, and if you want to iterate the map, which you need to do in a chaotic map if you want to see anything, you get a lot of decoherence anyway, and so things might be washed out. But we did find a way of actually extracting something from a realistic simulation with this bad molecule. We thought about something you could do and you could measure. Now this is this thing here, and this is related to hypersensitivity to perturbation, one thing I mentioned in the very beginning. I just mentioned this briefly, don't explain this in detail here. So what we do is we take the evolution of the Baker's map and perturb it in various ways. So we apply stochastic perturbations. Now we want to know in what sense all of Hilbert space, or in this case actually density operator space, because there is a lot of decoherence, so the final states are actually highly mixed density operators. You can see they actually have an interfere from the 2.5 bits in the end, so which is for a 3-qubit quantum computer quite a lot. So there's only half a bit of entropy left until you're completely mixed. So you want to know how these states explore all of Hilbert space. And the measure for that we proposed is this slope here, the slope in this curve. And this tells you, let's say you want to, if you just let the thing evolve and average over all your perturbations, you just get a maximally mixed state in the end. Now let's say you want to acquire information about the environment that reduces your system entropy by a little bit. Let's say you want to reduce the system entropy by 0.2 bits compared to the maximum entropy you get by not extracting any information from the perturbation. Well, this tells you that in this case you need about 1.2 bits of information about the environment. Our conjecture is that if the Hilbert space is completely explored, all the dimensions, all this huge Googleplexy number of states is explored by this, then the slope would be actually equal to the dimension of Hilbert space here. Well, the measure of Hilbert space is A, the slope is 6. I mean, this is an extremely small dimensional and really not very conclusive, but at least I think it's about as nice a distinction between a chaotic evolution and a regular evolution which you could expect in this kind of noisy test system. So this is the kind of data we would hope that somebody who did this experiment in this way will actually get. Actually, of course, the simulation of an NMR experiment, if you do them well, are indistinguishable from the final results if you do the NMR experiment well. So I do it. But never mind, that would apply to essentially all experiments you're doing all these in this field. But then as soon as you've got I would say 30 or 40 qubits, you wouldn't be able to do any classical simulation.
You have to start at 30. The experimentalists have to learn somewhere.
Yeah. So
it's not just a
matter of... No. It's not
right. They are learning, or they have already learned, but we're not
just... Okay. We were not trying to prove something about the quantum Baker's map. We found the Magic element, but that's not really something. This is nice, but you want this only to show something else. They're not in themselves a very, very interesting result. So what we wanted to prove is that there is, in what sense, or if there is in a sense, we can prove that there's a 1 bit per step entropy increase in this map. You have the classical map has a chaos entropy of 1 bit per step. So we wanted to show that the quantum map, in a certain sense, also has a 1 bit per step entropy increase. Now, an entropy increase you get if you introduce some source of uncertainty in the system. A various ways of doing that. Wojciech is looking at me, of course, thinks that the most sensible thing is of introducing noise into the systems via the environment. So you have an environment, it interacts with your system, you trace out the environment, you get your entropy increase. It's one way of introducing noise. Another way, which is actually in classical chaos even more standard, is by coarse graining. So
you do not look at the time evolution on a fine scale, but you just only look at it in at a coarser scale, some fixed scale. And then you also get this same entropy increase of your of 1 bit per step for the classical map. And so since we essentially failed, we tried to prove that the von Neumann entropy increases 1 bit per step if you trace out the environment for some sensible perturbation, but we failed. It's very difficult, even though we think of, I mean, the hope that things would be in any way as simple as classically, but this qubit representation has not quite been fulfilled. But at least we could find something. So we chose coarse graining instead. Coarse graining, you will see that the result in a sense is more limited than the other result would have been, but at least it is one rigorous result that shows an entropy increase of 1 bit per step.
Before you go on, do you understand why you failed? I mean, was it an interesting failure or just...
I was just because, well, you will see the entropy here is essentially a classical entropy, so it's a classical, it's an entropy of alternatives. Mm-hmm. It's not a von Neumann entropy. So the von Neumann entropy is just very difficult to calculate. That's the reason. So it's just incompetence, I guess.
But I would trace your square should be easier, shouldn't it?
Sorry?
Trace your square should be easier.
Oh yeah, that would be simpler thing. Yeah. But
we can prepare.
Yeah. Okay, so I give you a very brief introduction to decoherent histories, because the formalism of decoherent histories is how you coarse grain in quantum mechanics. So that's a systematic way of coarse graining a time evolution. So my problem with decoherent histories is that the formalism is unwieldy, and I certainly haven't found a way of showing in any nicer way, but it needs to specialize to our problem here, which makes it probably, hopefully, understandable. So we start with coarse grain projectors. Now, these states here, I mean, y underscore is just a string of length n minus l minus r, so that the whole string here is just an n-bit string, so this is one of our quantum Baker's net states. I don't put the position of the dot here because it's immaterial, so that could be anywhere. So this is a sum over all those left bits and all those right bits here. So it's a coarse grain projector. It's a projector on the subspace that's defined by this substring y here. So in a sense, it is a little blob. It's a projector on a little blob in phase space.
So you are sort of summing over least significant digits in some sense.
Yes. So here's a way of...
In both x and p, then.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Space space localized.
Yeah. Right. So, this is here. These are the projectors. Then, a history is just a... No, this is history is something that, in this case, I obviously should go on to k steps, k iterations. So it's a vector of k coarse projectors. That's one history. And so it's labeled by a vector of these strings. So I invited this awful video. I should apologize for this notation with an underscore. And but I took it straight from the paper. In the paper, the underscore thing is bold. So it isn't quite as bad. But then if you want to... But this is a vector of strings. So the next term we need is a set of histories. If you take now the set of all hy, for all possible strings y here, this is a pretty big set. Well, in this case, this is clearly an exhaustive set of mutually exclusive histories, because all these projectors are mutually orthogonal. So, very nicely partitioned. Well, whatever you want to partition. Next term, the decoherence functional. A decoherence functional is a functional, well, it depends on a initial state, rho 0, a history, hy, another history, hz. Obviously, this is the expression for it. So you start with your rho naught, you evolve it. This is what my student always says. You bake it once, he always says. So, of course, not quite baking it. It's really just folding it over once. But anyhow, you bake it once, then you project it on the PY1 here, PZ1 there, you bake it again, you project it on the next pair of projectors from these two histories, etc., and until you reach the end of the history of PYK and PZK. So that's called a decoherence functional. And then we can define what it means for two sets of knots, say, for one set of histories to be decoherent. And a simple definition, I mean, there's various types of decoherence, and well, this is the most straightforward definition here. A set of histories HY is decoherent, or satisfies this decoherence condition, if all the off-diagonal elements of the decoherence function will vanish. So if these two vectors of strings here differ, then this thing is zero. And this condition ensures that you can regard the diagonal elements, so those where the all the z's are identical to the y's, as probabilities. Let's see here. And then you can define the entropy of a set of histories by just taking the ordinary Shannon entropy of the of the probabilities p of h y, which are just the diagonal elements of the decoherence function. So that's the formalism. That's what we're looking at. And the result is this one here. Well, it's not a beautiful one, but it's not. So here it is. We have now we look at the Baker's map, and well, we take it. Don't tell you anything about one knot here. This is omitted. But take the
Baker's map. Any of those Baker's maps?
Sorry.
One particular one.
Any Baker's map.
Any one of those.
Any one of those. So it's an arbitrary one, yeah.
Even the one that's trivial.
Even the one that's trivial, or the one that is the one with Balazs and Sarrazin. Any Baker's map. And so if we have a diagonal element, so if y is equal to z, and the y's, which is the same as the z, satisfy a Debreceff shift condition. So the first y string actually is obtained from the second one by a shift by one bit, etc. That was shift condition. Well, of course, the last bits always are irrelevant. One of them always vanishes into the trace over region. Then you get 2 to the minus k plus an exponentially small term. Now, this k squared here is really ugly and shouldn't be there. And both Andre and I are convinced that one could get rid of it by working even harder. But for the moment, it's there. It's clearly can be traced back to the particular method we use to prove this, which is still not the optimal method. But if you actually do this, you get in such a mess of indices and strings and so on that it's really hard work. Anyway, this is essentially when the difference wouldn't be so big. What it means is that if you have a fixed number of iterations, you can choose your L, or the L, the actually the number of the momentum bits you trace over is the important one. You can choose your L big enough so that your histories have all equal probabilities 2 to the minus k, and actually are decoherent, because otherwise it's zero, so it means all the other probabilities are essentially zero, and also the decoherence condition is fulfilled exponentially well as you like. And then it is an almost trivial corollary that, except for the details here of this term, but that the entropy increases in entropy equal to k. So it goes like k.
So the size of your square limits the number of Baker's map that you can apply with having a consistent
yes, indeed, yeah. Exactly. So this is a result that is somewhere in the middle of saying something about the quantum map and the classical limit. So it's also, I mean, this is in a sense also a statement about approaching classical limit here.
So can you remind us what little L is? Because that appears to be the crucial thing that has to go to infinity. Is that right?
Yep. What well, is?
That's the left. That's the coarse graining and momentum.
Mm-hmm. That's the coarse graining and momentum, yeah. So that is the number of momentum bits you trace out.
So you didn't have to obtain any momentum, but you'd be in trouble.
Yes.
Why is it asymmetric
with your momentum position? Well, that's a good question. Maybe it shouldn't be. And I have...
Because you're running the map forward, that seems very clear.
Yeah.
the elements or the garbage heap that you're throwing your extra information into, if there aren't any, there's no garbage heap and it just piles up.
But it comes back from the other side, so but there's another asymmetry which might be more relevant, which is that it's the same asymmetry you saw in the matrix element. You have a perfect delta function for the position bits, but you have this sine one, this less well defined delta function for the momentum bits. So this is an asymmetric map, and I found ways of writing a quantum Baker's map, but it wouldn't be related to this original quantization anymore, which is symmetric in this sense. So which really takes, you just need to write down a basis, which since your basis of symmetrically localized states, and then define your action of your map on these localized states, and then you would get something that wouldn't have to say symmetry. But let's just.
But then it means you don't actually have to correspond at all in position, right? So you could have things that occupy only one position sign as your projectors. Is that right? And it would still work.
Yep. Well, here's something else which is confuses me, and maybe it's just a joke. I'm not quite sure. Of course, I mean, it looks like the non-trivial. When you have this hierarchy of maps here. Hierarchy of maps. Where's my slide on that? Well, remember there was one that where you had lots of gates everywhere, which is the original model. Then you had one where you had just a shift, a cyclic shift of the qubit, and a lonely Hadamard sitting somewhere. So the one with the lonely Hadamard is clearly a very boring map. And the other one is much more complex and much more interesting in a way. But both are quantization of the Baker's map and have the right classical limit. Now, if you did take this trivial one seriously, and you can easily derive results for this trivial map. Well, this is almost not worth writing down when I did it anyway. So you have this trivial quantum Baker's map just with this one Hadamard and the shift, and you have an environment which just is, say, a system here which comes, interacts with this qubit and goes away, and the next one comes, interacts with this one and goes away, etc. And then, I mean, it's easy to see that you can arrange things, certainly by making this environment big enough and by making this interaction complex enough, that essentially the state after k iterations is your initial state for the first n minus k qubits, and there's the completely mixed state for the rest of the remaining k qubits. And what you've got is a phenomenal entropy increase of k bits. Now, the question is, I mean, is this all there is to this entropy increase for the environment? And what do you learn additionally if you look at more complicated maps? It's worth looking at more complicated maps. Just don't know. Also, it's tempting. I mean, I have always this. This map clearly would not show the hypersensitivity to perturbation I was describing, because all the states you ever access are product states here. So you're nowhere close to getting in all these beautiful many Hilbert space dimensions you have. So.
Why does the environment only act on one bit? What if I had an environment that acted on two bits?
Ooh, the $10,000 question.
Yes, oh, okay. That would be... That... Okay. The reason why the environment acts only on the bits down here is that it should be local in phase space. Because if you want to retain any similarity to classical chaos, you need to have perturbations or interactions which in phase space look local, look small.
Okay, well, I have one here and one there.
But you could have two.
Yeah.
Every second step.
So if you indeed,
n per
second. If you take arbitrary unitaries and two qubits here, then you can see that just by iterating the map and applying these arbitrary two-qubit perturbations, you can reach any state you want, because this is clearly enough to do a whole quantum computation.
I'm just wondering if I put the red dot on another line at the same time, would the entropy become 2k bits?
No. No, no, if you just do that, if you have several environments interacting with various dots, you have the same increase. It would increase by a lot immediately. First step, but then it would go by one, it would go up by one, 1 bit.
You'd just be missing a bit you'd already missed.
It can't be messed up
anymore.
Yeah, it's already maximally messed up.
Okay. So this
is
kind of irrelevant. Atomize irrelevant, yeah. Yes.
So the only thing that's important is the perturbation.
I set this up in such a way that if this is a C naught here and this is a totally mixed bit, then you would get the totally mixed stuff. If you then just swap these two, you suddenly wouldn't get any entropy increase at all. But that is just because I chose to have such a small environment here.
The point is that the interaction must entangle pretty well. If it doesn't, then
you don't. Well, but even then, if it's just a qubit, you can always arrange initial states in such a way that it won't do anything at all.
That's right. So, yeah.
I'm still a little bit confused about the coarse graining that we're doing, because it seemed like from the discussion that happened here, when you do this coarse graining projection, you determine the amount of sort of the width of the window and momentum, but the position didn't matter. So you could have a very narrow, as Carl was saying, window position. But how can that be a subspace? How can you project onto, for instance, half the width of your unit square in momentum and only one in position? I mean, that's smaller than a state, right?
Am I missing something? No, that will never happen. You would always project on something that is a line in position, but then much fatter than, No, it wouldn't be a line, because it would be position eigenstate. It would be partially fully transformed. Okay, so it would be, the width would be half. If you have just a single position bit and all the others are momentum bits, then the width is one half the square.
Does the position eigenstate look like...
It isn't a position eigenstate. It is a state that is, you take a position eigenstate and then you fully transform n minus one bits. So what you get is one that is perfectly localized in half the square.
How's that a coarse graining? I'm confused about this coarse graining process. It seems like you would have to...
It's a pretty bad coarse graining. The cells look like this then. They have this structure. You have a lot of cells. So these are your cells that are similar here.
Right.
Well, this is the coarse graining, because the fine grain thing would look like...
The fine grain is coarser than that, right?
No.
What is it? I mean, the minimum, a single state, this is a phase space, right?
Yeah.
So a single state looks like a line all the way across.
No.
No.
No, one of these states, if you have a state like this, one of these states that have A1 to AN minus 1 dot AN, let's say a state like this, right?
Well, right, okay, that's one basis you can pick.
Yeah, but this is what you're talking about, where you have a single position bit, isn't it?
What I'm saying is, suppose I were to pick a very boring basis, just a position basis, right? Mm-hmm. Then those basis states look like lines.
Yes, right.
The coarse graining here is onto half lines. That's smaller than a single state.
Yeah, you couldn't coarse grain that in the ones you're talking about, yeah, in the way it wants to. You've got to start with stuff on both sides of the decimal point, yeah, to get the kind of coarse grain he wants. And so those aren't, they're already blobbed out in both position and momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. These lines are thick.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out, how thick those lines have to be, because they're always saying they could be just one bit of line. But I have a feeling I'm just confusing everyone, so I'll shut up now.
Yeah.
I think what...
They only have to be as wide as whatever you're starting with, but you can't start with something that's position I can say.
Okay. You have the ability to
put places at different places in momentum, and you can't do that.
So you just have to have in momentum bits on the left that you can sum over. Okay. And then if you sum over them, of course you get a lot of states taken together, and it's closer than nothing. So okay, one question I would like to ask is, is this all there is to entropy increase? So why is it interesting to
search for linear entropy increase in more complicated maps. Similarly, similar example is this one here. It's another signature of quantum chaos, which is due to Usher Paris.
Are you going to give us any head on that?
No.
Answer, or are you just going to ask it?
I'm just going to ask it. I don't know the answer.
Should we attempt to answer, or won't you answer?
Maybe at the end, because let me just say this, because this is the same example. Similar. It's a completely different criterion, though, not completely different. But let's take the same Baker's law, but not a systematic error. So you either have this map here, or this map with a small systematic error. So each time you have the same U epsilon acting here. Then after k iterations, what you get here is this state, n minus k zeros and k psi's, but these are just these 0 plus 1 states. And if you apply the systematic error, well, you get this state after k iterations. And now I'll just assume that the epsilon just labels this thing here. So if I have psi u epsilon psi mod, then I get 1 minus epsilon is less than 1. So they actually do something to the state. Well, then you can see that the overlap of these two states without and with systematic error just goes down like 1 minus epsilon to the k. And this is the phenomenon that Usher Paris showed in his book I didn't use supercomputers, but computers he had, where he just shows that the overlap of two states in the kick top just goes diverges like this. And again, the question is, does this capture the phenomenon, or what else is there to quantum chaos? And I, of course, would like to look for a criterion of signature for quantum chaos, which could not be, would not be found in this uninteresting map.
Why?
Oh, because it looks like there should be more. There should be complexity. See, chaos isn't a complex. This isn't complex. So I would like to learn something about quantum information and quantum chaos from the study, and this doesn't tell me anything. I don't learn anything from this.
So if you have a simple answer, you don't like it.
I mean, what's here is
that? Oh, okay.
Well, I think there's something also to be said about this calculation that you did. These overlaps never go to zero. They always have to. And that's every single thing that anyone's ever done in quantum chaos, that's been a failure. That the t going to infinity asymptotics that are necessary to define classical chaos never work. So I think you're right. I think that's really something one needs to think very carefully about. So I think.
Well, in that sense, the one I've shown with my course going works. I mean, if you take d to infinity, you get...
No, but I'm saying with Hamiltonians, like...
Yeah, okay.
I like Hamiltonians.
Yeah.
If you do that, then you run into this.
Okay.
Because your phase space is bounded, there's not too much of a function can do after a while. You would have to stay on top of each other.
Is this... Well, it has to do with the observation that if you take random vectors, that... they'll be almost but not quite orthogonal.
That's what's going to happen. So that's one of the difficulties. That the asymptotics of quantum mechanics isn't the same as the classical theory, where you can go down to arbitrarily small scales as t goes to infinity. So I think in real, dynamical systems, that's the problem.
Yeah, what I'm looking for is an intrinsic quantum mechanical signature characterization. So, I mean, there's lots of very interesting questions in going to the classical limits.
Chaos or random
direction? Chaos.
No, I think it's possible. In fact, we are working on that. I don't have the chance to say right now, but I think it's...
Well, what about random reproduction rate? Yeah,
sorry.
Incredible amount. Just to reverse your previous comparison.
Okay. You want to give an answer?
No. Well, no, I mean, in that case, you would have entropy production in presence of the environment, which would be, one could guess, or one could conjecture at least, linear in the sum of the Fermat exponents or something. Why, in the regular system, you wouldn't have that?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, this is, I mean, I'm just asking, looking at this, you don't seem to learn much, or maybe you do. I just don't know what it is.
So you're saying these could be the answers, but somehow if they are, you're very surprised that it's that trivial and you prefer to find a harder answer.
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
Well, same problem we had before.
When you write this in terms of qubits, I mean, a similar classical system, what you've got there, is something described by a single and at every time step, you multiply the number by 2.
Well,
And that, that
almost, it's just a shift of a dot. It's a little more complicated, but yeah, essentially.
Sure, I mean, perhaps you cycle a bit around.
Okay, if you don't want to do that, you can also do it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, so that, I mean, that number diverges exponentially. So it's an incredibly simple, classically chaotic. I mean, it's not chaotic, but it sort of satisfies the criteria, right?
Well, it doesn't go up. Yeah, it, I mean, the symbolic dynamic is incredibly simple. And here's one possible answer, which actually, I mean, I know of one paper where people have attempted to do something in this direction. The problem is, classically, you could say the same thing. All these quantum maps, or quantum, I mean, even Hamiltonian systems, if you discretize them, are equivalent to symbolic dynamics. So it's just shifts. It's just the same trivial thing you're talking about. But you can see all these phenomena there. The interesting or difficult part that tells something of the actual map system is the mapping of is finding the partition. Well, that's difficult and that's interesting. And once you've done that, you're essentially done with the map. Now, I have found some sort of this representation only in the most trivial case. Maybe it is very hard and almost maybe impossible to find this kind of thing for a generic quantum map. This is probably true. This is a paper by Vallejos and Saraceno 2 years ago, constructing a quantum Markov partition, where they make some headway in that, and the direction to constructing this sort of thing.
I'm confused to what degree the qubit representation of this is important. As to say, if I look at this as an eight-dimensional system,
mm-hmm.
I can think about this as a unitary transmission. So I can imagine a spin set in half atom, and there's some transformation on that. And I would guess each one of these quantum Baker's maps is a different unitary transformation on that eight-dimensional system.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, in that case, I wouldn't have the nice shift representation of states. I mean, I wouldn't be able to label the states in with these kinds of symbolic dynamics.
Yeah.
But I would have the same quantum dynamics.
No, I would think this is important only to be able to see things better.
Right. But I would say, yeah, I guess, you know, if the phenomenon, well, I guess maybe the question I'm asking is, does the phenomenon that you're looking for, this quantum signature of chaos, rely on having this partition of the tensor product structure in an open space? In other words, I have two isomorphic structures, one that doesn't have a tensor product because it's their unitary dynamics, and another one that does have this tensor structure. I could do coarse graining the same way.
It seems pretty clear in this example here that the tensor product structure helps you to just see something trivially, which would be hidden and maybe very difficult to detect otherwise.
So what you're saying, it might be hard, as you were saying, to construct this kind of shift representation, let's say, in prime dimensions instead of in powers of two.
Well, yes, maybe.
Well, of course, if you choose to map your states on the states of an atom, and you just choose to the eigenstate of the map as the energy eigenstate of the atom, you won't have
any chaos. Oh, well, but that is the remark I made before, that you, in order to have chaos, you always need some notion of what the small perturbation is. And in this case, I mean, I have this. This is why I always go back and forth between the phase space and this qubit, because otherwise.
And the phase space is what tells you that.
Yes, sure. Exactly.
So and some way of mapping getting beyond Hilbert space, otherwise, there's no structure there to work with.
I need to coarse grain somehow over some scale, so there would be some equivalent coarse graining of the spectrum of the Rydberg atoms.
Which is why doing a simulation in a decohering NMR system is not simulating decoherence in a Baker's map. Because then you are feeding your noise to most significant digits at the same rate as the least significant which is not good.
Well, in our simulations and simulations, we put in extra noise by hair.
Good for you. That's fine.
Simulation is squared.
Yeah, I think we moved into a question period, so we should probably thank our students.